down South America, South Africa for 2 weeks, and as I travel around the United States, there is a verse that God keeps branding into my conscience that says this: without a vision, the people perish. And a vision, in the Old Testament sense of the word, is the means whereby God revealed His will for men and nations. So that what that verse is saying, and the word perish literally means ungovernable, so that what that verse is saying is, without commitment to the revelation of the will of God for men and nations, people are ungovernable. And I saw that to be true in South Africa, and I see that to be true in the United States. But let me start out by reading to you some quotes from various lectures and periodicals produced in South Africa by South Africans to give you a little perspective that you will not get in the national media. For instance, here is a speech that was internationally televised, an official speech by the president of South Africa, President Botha. And in this speech, he says, "However, I believe that the majority of South Africans, as well as the citizens of the independent states who are our immediate neighbors, have much in common apart from economic interests. We believe in the same Almighty God and in the redeeming grace of His Son, the Lord Jesus Christ." Here's how he concluded this internationally televised message: "We undertake to do all that man can possibly do. In so saying, I pray that Almighty God grant us the wisdom and the strength to seek to fulfill His will." Here is another major address by the President of South Africa, and this address is concluded with these words: "Let us now also develop the faith and love for real freedom. Freedom is not possible without discipline. Faith is not possible without God." And I had written down here, and I hope I brought the right one, the preamble to the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa: "In humble reliance and submission to Almighty God, who controls the destinies of peoples and nations, who gathered our forebears together from many lands and gave them this their own, who has guided them from generation to generation, who has wondrously delivered them from the dangers that beset them, we declare that we are conscious of our responsibility towards God and man to uphold Christian values and civilized norms with recognition and protection of freedom of faith and worship." And here is a speech that I heard personally given by the Brigadier of the South African Police Force. Says, "I have been asked to address you on the subject of the internal security situation and the role of the African National Congress with regard to its Marxist-inspired campaign of terrorism. I do so with great willingness because I know that I am addressing a group which represents those Americans who share the same Christian-oriented and biblically-based outlook as do most South Africans." In an interview that Jerry Falwell had with the President of South Africa, the President says this: "I believe that any successful application of the policy of disinvestment would have catastrophic results for the peoples whom the United States wishes to develop in South Africa. The Republic of South Africa is not only important to its citizens, it's important to its neighbors. More than 1.5 million of them have flocked into our country over the past number of years to come and seek work in the Republic of South Africa, so we're important to our neighbors. Secondly, the Republic of South Africa is a Christian country. We're developing and furthering the interests of Christianity. We state so in our Constitution, and we live according to that. We fail as human beings, but we've never rejected the human dignity under God, and we will continue as we did in the past to work for civilized standards." Now, these are not only statements in various periodicals, but as I talked to countless numbers of people over the 2 weeks I was there, including over 100 set appointments in 10 days. The vast majority of people that I've talked to, both governmental officials, black people, colored people, Indian people, the vast majority of them said they were Christian, understood that the Bible is the Word of God, and although none of us are perfect, and the government of South Africa is not perfect, no one that I talked to in South Africa even conceived of South Africa as ever being religiously neutral. That from the average citizen, be he black or white, to the upper echelons of government in South Africa, everybody understood South Africa's only hope for the future is for it to remain steadfast on its Christian base. I would like now to recommend to you some good sources where you can get some reliable information on what's going on in South Africa, because a couple of the reasons why I went was I wanted to find out for myself, number one, whether or not the picture that the national media was portraying of South Africa was accurate, and number two, what the effects of the government's policy of divestment has on black people in South Africa. And as I looked at the situation in South Africa for 2 weeks, I wasn't surprised the national media presents a one-sided, unbalanced view. And so if you have a pencil or paper, I'd like to recommend to you what I think are some of the most reliable sources for information about what's really happening in South Africa. First of all, the Washington Report, Howard Phillips' Washington Report, is one of the most strategically important newsletters concerning keeping tabs on what's going on in South Africa and what we as Christians should do. If you want to get Howard Phillips' Washington Report, I'm sure it'll have some subscription rate, but send a letter to American Bureau of Economic Research, P.O. Box 8204, Fort Worth, Texas, 76124. 76124. Also, a new magazine this is only its second issue, but the editor of this magazine has attended church here at Chalcedon. His name is Jeffrey St. John. And this is on its way of being one of the leading conservative news weeklies in the United States. It comes out every week. It's just 2 weeks old, and it's called The New American. And I don't have the address right here, but it's up here on the table. And you can see the attitude of this magazine from the byline on the front page, "Why Not Sanctions Against the Soviets?" Also, there's another news magazine that's produced by Washington Times called Insight that also is very helpful in understanding what's in South Africa. To me, the most effective newsletter is this newsletter called African Intelligence Digest. This has been a goldmine for me. This has information in it that you can't get anywhere else. Costs about $40 a year, but I highly recommend the African Intelligence Digest. Also, the South African government is glad to send you a monthly magazine. This is called the South African Digest, and all you have to do is write them and tell them you'd like for them to send it to you. I've been getting it every month for years, and they'll be glad to send it to you if you write them and ask them. So much for various source material. Let me tell you where I was in South Africa very quickly. South Africa is the very southern tip of the continent of Africa. It's bordered on one side of the Atlantic Ocean, 1,800 miles north of Antarctica, bordered on the other side by the Indian Ocean, and then surrounded by various other black African nations such as Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Botswana, and Angola. Northwest Africa is a colony, so to speak, a protective territory of South Africa. Takes 18 hours to fly from New York to South Africa. So we flew from New York to Johannesburg, which is a big metropolitan area, and I got off, and for the next 2 days, I wasn't aware I was in Africa. I thought I was in Atlanta still, big metropolitan area, and flew from there to Pretoria. Pretoria is the administrative capital of South Africa. It's where the president resides. And then from Pretoria, we flew over here to the Kruger National Park. I'm sure you've seen some of that in National Geographic magazine. And we stayed at a little private park in the Kruger National Park called Sabi Sabi Game Reserve, where I did what I've always wanted to do ever since I saw my first National Geographic. And that is live in a little mud hut with a thatched roof, air conditioned, and eat antelope during the day, and get up early in the morning and late afternoon and spend hours riding around in a Land Rover and driving right up to white rhinoceros, hippopotamus, water buffalo, giraffe, I mean, you know, my heart's desire. So we stayed there a couple days. Then we flew from there down to Durban, which is on the Indian Ocean. And from Durban, we flew up into KwaZulu. Now, KwaZulu is Zululand, and Zulus are 6 million strong here. We went to the capital of KwaZulu in Ulundi and met with the number one and number two men in the Zulu government under Chief Gotjobuthelezi. And this number one and number two men are both Christians, along with the chief minister of the entire Zulu nation. From there, we flew over here to Cape Town, which is known as one of the most beautiful places in all the world. And it is that. From there, we went to Stellenbosch, which is one of the centers of institutes of reformed higher education. And from there, we flew back to Johannesburg and Pretoria, and then flew back home. 2 weeks in all, over 100 interviews in those 10 days. Now, let me tell you something very quickly about the background and history and culture of South Africa, and move into some of the more critically important things. About the same time, literally, that Columbus came to North America, Portuguese sailors like de Gama and Diaz came to the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa. And about the same time that the pilgrims who came from Great Britain by way of Holland landed in North America, virtually at the same time and amongst the same kind of people in Holland, there were immigrants that came down and settled in South Africa. So that the same outlook and the same perspective and religious commitment that dominated the pilgrims who came to this country to establish a Christian nation in the United States, that same outlook, an outlook that was molded and forged in the Protestant Reformation, that same outlook dominated the perspective of those people from Netherlands that came in the 1600s, not long after the pilgrims came to America, and began to settle here in South Africa. And that distinctively Christian commitment has dominated politics and virtually every other aspect of life in South Africa from that time to this. South Africa is a microcosm of the whole world in the tip of Africa. Now, one of the mistakes that Americans make is that they assume that their situation is the same as ours back in the 40s and 50s, and we've just done a better job of race relations. Well, if you look at South Africa from that perspective, you're going to misunderstand the whole situation. We're totally different. The United States today is basically one culture with a variety of subcultures. It's a melting pot. Black, yellow, white, basically one melting pot type culture with a variety of subcultures in it. South Africa is not that way. South Africa was originally inhabited by two kinds of people. We call them Bushmen and Hottentots. They don't appreciate those names, but that's the way American and English people, speaking people, describe them. The white Dutchmen and the black Bantu people immigrated into South Africa about the same time. Most people don't realize the blacks were not the original inhabitants of South Africa. That the whites came through the Cape about the same period of time that the blacks migrated down from Central Africa. The original inhabitants were Bushmen, which were yellow-skinned people, and there are very few of them left, and they're basically up in here, and they're still very primitive. And the Hottentots, or better called the Griquas, which were brown-skinned, straight-haired people. And I had the privilege of talking with some of the few of the Greek ones that are left in South Africa. About the turn of the century, 1900, and before, Great Britain realized the value of South Africa. Gold, the diamond, the sea lane. And so Great Britain imperialistically invaded South Africa, the white Dutch people in South Africa. And the turn of the century, there was a tremendous and bloody Anglo-Boer War, B-O-E-War, you've heard of the Boer War. Boer simply means farmer. A Boer is a Dutch farmer. By the way, when these Dutchmen landed in South Africa, once their children started being born in South Africa, they called them Afrikaners. And eventually, the language Afrikaans, A-F-R-I-K-A-A-N-S, was born. And by the way, Afrikaans is the world's most modern language. It was born just in the past 100 years or so, a couple hundred years. So the Dutchmen settled here. Turn of the century, the English invaded. Anglo-Boer War. Some 25,000 Afrikaners died in British concentration camps. And if you think Southerners in the United States haven't forgotten the Civil War, then my friend, these Afrikaners haven't forgotten the Anglo-Boer War. I talked to one man who said, I'll never forget that my grandmother died in a British concentration camp. So obviously over the years, the English and the Afrikaner cultures have blended, but nevertheless, you can recognize an Englishman by his lifestyle and his language, and you can recognize an Afrikaner. So there's two basic, though blended, white cultures in South Africa. This, in this section, is largely English, and up in this section where the Afrikaners finally had to go to escape persecution and the like is largely Afrikaners. Of the 5 million or so white people in South Africa, 60% of them are Afrikaners, and about 40% of them are English-speaking, though English and Afrikaans are the national languages, and everybody has to learn both. Now, besides these white cultures, there are some 10 or 11 different black cultures. You've read in the newspaper about the black majority, the white minority and the black majority in South Africa. There is no black majority in South Africa. That there are at least 10 different black minorities, different population groups with different cultures, different lifestyles, different languages, and each one of those 10 or 11 population groups made up of some 200 smaller tribes with their own little distinctives. Throughout history, just as the English and the Afrikaans have a history of conflict between each other, these various black population groups have been known for their conflict. Now, it's interesting how the whites in South Africa are very quick to remind us of how these various black cultures don't get along, and that's why we've got to keep them apart. But they often forget that the white cultures have been at conflict for some 200 years as well. So you have these major population groups. Now, along with these 10 or 11 black population groups, you also have a colored, with a capital C, a colored culture. Now, colored is a legal term, and it describes those hundreds of thousands of people, largely down in here, called Cape Colored, that are descendants of the Dutch intermarrying with Malaysian people that they brought in from the East Indies, intermarrying with the Hottentot, the Griqua people, and this mixed population is a legal category in and of itself, and then there are a few hundred thousand Asians in South Africa. Now, you've heard a word spelled A-P-A-R-T-H-E-I-D. The way the South Africans pronounce that word is apartheid. Apartheid. We call it apartheid, but apartheid is what they call it. And throughout South Africa's history, there has been the separation of these various cultures. They've had their various areas, their various geographical boundaries, their various lifestyles. They've pretty much kept separate, though there has been some blending through the years. Well, in 1948, the Nationalist Party was elected to office. And it's largely an Afrikaner-speaking political party. And those people have dominated politics. That party's been in power legitimately through elections since 1948. The Afrikaner populace, some 60% of these white people, by the way, there are about 30 million people in South Africa, 5 million of whom are white, 6 million of whom are Zulu, and the rest, various other black cultures, and Indian, Asian, and colored. The unifying factor of the Afrikaner culture politically is the Nationalist Party. They've been in power since 1948. The unifying factor religiously and ecclesiastically is the Dutch Reformed Church. Now, the Dutch Reformed Church is a Presbyterian and a Calvinistic body, and it by far and away is the most dominant denomination among the whites in South Africa. Many of the English are Anglican. There's a few Baptists and various Methodists and groups like that, a few Roman Catholics, but the overwhelming majority of people, particularly in governmental offices, are members of the Dutch Reformed Church. And, of course, Dutch Reformed, that tells you their history, going back to the 1600s, rooted in the fires of the Protestant Reformation about the same time that the Pilgrims were in Holland. It's interesting that among the various non-white groups, the majority of the people that I talked to, and I got the impression the majority of these people are Christians. They're members of various churches. I met black people who were members of the Dutch Reformed Church, black Zulu chaplain who was a member of the Reformed Presbyterian Church of South Africa, and we struck up a good friendship. And many of these black and non-white groups have been evangelized through the years by various Protestant Reformed bodies of one way or another. One of the biggest single Christian groups among the blacks is a group called the Reformed Independent Association of Churches, some 4 million strong. And so you see the influence of the Protestant Reformation throughout this whole culture. Well, in 1948, the Nationalist Party put into law this segregation of society that had been going on now for many, many decades. They said the way it is the way it must be. Now, there are three things. If you learn anything this evening, I hope you learn these three things about South African culture, that if there's going to be any kind of government that's going to preserve liberty and justice for everybody, then it's got to be a government that preserves these three principles. Now, you haven't gotten this in the press either, but this is absolutely essential to understanding all of the problems and the reforms and the difficulty and the confusion in South Africa. In order for a government to respect everybody's dignity, freedom, and to rights, and to administer justice across the board, that government must not compromise these three principles. Number one, it must recognize the reality of diverse cultures in South Africa. It cannot demand the Zulus to live like the Xhosa, or the Xhosa to live like the Tswana, or the Afrikaners to live like the English. That there are diverse, clear-cut cultures in South Africa, and any government must respect the reality of those different cultures. Number two, every culture must be brought into full participation of the political and social life of South Africa. Every culture must be brought into full participation of the social and political life of South Africa. And number three, this must be done in such a way that no one culture or population group dominates the rest. I'm glad I don't have to figure that out. And frankly, besides the biblical guidelines that God gives us, I have no idea exactly how to work out those three principles. They got a job on their hands. But that's what they have to work with. That's the ground rules. The reality of diverse cultures and population groups, the fact that each one of these must be brought into full participation in the governmental life, and it must be done in such a way that not one population group does not dominate any other. Well, now, the attempt of the Afrikaners to deal with those three is apartheid. But apartheid is a total failure. I sympathize with their concern to want to respect the various cultures, but apartheid has produced a vast host of degrading and dehumanizing policies and laws for all races. If you want to learn what apartheid is, the best way to learn what apartheid is from the air. As I was flying from Durban to Cape Town over Stellenbosch, this area right here is gorgeous wine country, vineyards, farms. And as you got 40 miles out of Cape Town, you saw these beautiful, well-kept farms, these gorgeous Cape Dutch houses. You see these beautiful, well-planned cities, and you have your breath taken away until all of a sudden your eye catches, apart from the farm and outside the city limits, these massive corral-like townships where hundreds of thousands of black people are herded and required by law to live. And then you realize apartheid isn't the answer. And it was amazing to me to see, it wasn't really amazing, but it was saddening to me to see the kinds of laws that were in effect with the excuse to maintain the different cultures, but which I'm convinced are racist at heart. For instance, it's been illegal until recently for black, in fact, to today, for black people to have political parties. Black people have been required to live by law in group areas, and the coloreds have their group where they have to live, and the Indians have their group area, and the whites have their group area. Another law is passed by the since 1948 is that no black man may be offered a skilled job. Until recently that was done away with, but that's what's dominated the labor market. No black man can be offered a skilled job. Against the law to offer a black man, it has been a skilled job in South Africa. So there are some racist policies. You say, Joe, what about all these high sounding Christian things that you read about the first? Well, America was a Christian nation, too, in the 30s and the 40s and the 20s and the 50s, but she was racist. We got black racists in this country. We have white racists in this country. And we're a fallen people, and we're a sinful people. But the fact that we have those glaring mistakes in certain areas of our life do not have to negate the fact that we are Christian in other areas of our life. For instance, in many ways, South Africa is more Christian than the United States. You know why? In what areas I'm talking about? Abortion is outlawed. Homosexuality is outlawed. Pornography is outlawed. Rapists and murderers, after a swift trial and conviction, are executed. So there's still many good and redeeming features about South African government. The only thing we can see is this terrible racial problem that's causing so much inequalities, injustice, etc., throughout the whole land. Now, in this scene has come, white men and black men have the same job. They're paid differently, even when they work for the government. Those who work for the government, black men, many of them, make less than white men who have the same job. So you can imagine how hostility is built throughout the years. And with this hostility, the whole situation has been ripe for Marxist terrorism to make inroads among South African blacks and various other discontented people. And that's exactly what has happened. Some organizations that you need to be aware of, and I'm sure you've read about them in the newspapers, the African National Congress. The African National Congress is a Marxist terrorist organization backed by the Soviet Union, dedicated to the violent overthrow of the South African government and of democracy, and has taken credit gladly for the burnings of several people in South Africa. By the way, I saw on television with my own eyes as much as I could watch. I saw from start to finish a black woman being burned and kicked to death with a massive stone dropped on her body by black people agitated by Marxist terror. Some 600 black people have died recently, most of whom have been killed by black terrorists. And the African National Congress is one of those terrorist organizations behind it all, along with the United Democratic Front. That's a nice, high-sounding title, isn't it? That's another Marxist terrorist group. And then I'm sure you've read about SWAPO, Southwest Africa People's Organization. Those are just a few of our friendly Marxist terrorists. Now, one of the highlights of my trip was speaking to a black mayor of a black township of several hundred thousand blacks, and his name is Mayor Linda, L-I-N-D-A. And here's a letter from him, and talks about his city and everything like that. And this was not an appointment the government made. This was an appointment we made on our own, and some people helped us, by the way. Let me tell you two other good organizations that you need to pray for. One is called Victims Against Terrorism. Victims Against Terrorism has some periodicals here that I bought in this book you might want to look at. These are tremendous people, Christians, anti-communists, who fear for the very future of South Africa and of the United States because of the Marxist terror. Victims Against Terrorism. Another group is called United Christian Action. United Christian Action is a distinctively Christian group that puts out some magazines called Signposts that you want to look at, and I'm sure that they would be glad for you to subscribe to some of these things because they tell you the truth about things like the World Council of Churches, what they're really doing in South Africa, and the like. And by the way, this United Christian Action group, one of their active members is the head of the Reformed Independent Association of Churches, which is 4 million black people. So these people, United Christian Action Group and the Victims Against Terrorism, set up many appointments for us with various groups, and one of those appointments was Mayor Linda. Mayor Linda was a black man. As I said, the mayor of a township of several hundred blacks and near Port Elizabeth, South Africa. And he also is the president of the Council of Black Mayors for all the black townships in that whole area around Port Elizabeth. So this is an important man. And we asked him the question. We said, in American press and TV, whenever there's a funeral or a demonstration or a riot, there are thousands of black people there. And the mayor had just told us that most black people in his township, as well as the other townships, most black people were tired of the property destruction. They were tired of the intimidation. They were anti-Marxist. And so it was in the light of that statement that we asked, if that's the case, how can the thousands of people come to these funerals and these demonstrations? Mayor Linda said, because of the well-organized system of runners these Marxist organizations have. The townships are hundreds of thousands of blacks crammed closely together. Some houses are nice little houses. Some of them are not nice at all. But there's a variety. They're not all poverty-stricken like you're led to believe in the press. Some of them are nice little houses. He said they have a well-organized system of runners that go around to every house in the township and tell them, unless you show up at the funeral or the demonstration, we're going to burn you in your house. So out of utter terror, they go to the funeral, and then they ransack their house while they're gone. Mayor Linda said, I know this is true because they burned down my house. They threatened the welfare of my family. I had to move my whole family to some secret place because I would not cooperate. And Mayor Linda went to President Mbowdi. You know, the policemen in South Africa use rubber bullets in their guns. And black Mayor Linda went to President Mbowdi and pled with him to allow the policemen to use live ammunition in their weaponry. He said, you've got to treat the terrorists with greater severity. And that's a black mayor. And the way the Marxists do, you know, you hear about these children dying and the like. The Marxist terrorists put the children in the front and teach them to throw the stones. I mean, these little children don't know anything about dialectical materialism. They don't know anything about the benefits of Marxism or Lenin or Karl Marx. They're doing it because everybody else is doing it and because they're intimidated and terrorized by the Marxist blacks. For instance, one group of our party was in a police truck, and as they were driving down the road, a whole crowd of little guys, 4 and 5 years old, came running out of the woods throwing rocks to police trucks. 4 and 5 years old. South African white policeman rolled down his window, looked out at him, and growled. And these little 4 and 5 year olds threw down the stones and started giggling, running back into the woods. So you see, it's typical Marxist tricks and Marxist strategy. They did the same thing in Vietnam, where little children would come up and kill American troops. They do the same thing in Afghanistan. A keystone of Marxist strategy is terror. And that's what's happening in the black townships. The South African apartheid racist policy have produced discontentment, hostility, and the Marxists have moved in to take advantage of the situation. It is the purpose of the Soviet Union to surround South Africa with Marxist dictatorship and eventually pull South Africa into the Soviet bloc. The Soviets have said that. They published it. I've read material by the Soviets. So what do we have around South Africa? We have over here Mozambique. Mozambique is a Marxist totalitarian regime. Its economy is in shambles. It has a group of anti-communist freedom fighters called RENAMO, R-E-N-A-M-O. The army in power is FRELIMO, F-R-E-L-I-M-O. RENAMO, the good guys. But they're disorganized. They don't have any one leader. All they know is they want to overthrow the totalitarian government of Mozambique. Mr. Michel, the dictator of Mozambique, to the shame of all Americans, was welcomed recently by the White House. Let me tell you how Mr. Michel shows his gratitude to East Germany and the Soviet bloc for helping him take over the country. He sends tens of thousands of young boys to the Soviet bloc to be used in slave labor camps. Tens of thousands of Mozambican boys. And then you also know about Zimbabwe and the genocide that's taking place there on the part of the government toward some anti-communist rebels down here in the bottom part of Zimbabwe. And then you also know about Angola, a Marxist regime, totalitarian power, and yet there is a Christian man called Dr. Zavimbi and his UNITA forces, which are so strong that they've taken over some two-thirds of Angola. And the only thing that's remaining is the capital of Angola, which is the stronghold of the Marxists. Mr. Zavimbi has taken over the major railroads, the source of the major diamond area, and three-fourths of the land. You know what keeps the Marxists in power? They only have one source of income, and that is Gulf oil in Angola, that through their oil pumps into that Marxist regime, and this is the only thing that keeps them in power, multi-million dollars worth of oil and trade every year. Gulf oil keeps the Marxists in power in Angola. And also, there is a thing in the Senate of the United States called the Clark Amendment. And the Clark Amendment, it makes it against the law for the United States to send any assistance to Zavimbi. The United States support goes to the totalitarian regime. The United States support goes to the totalitarian regime of Mozambique. Now, you've read in the paper about how the United States has condemned South Africa for invading Angola. You see, the situation here is the old League of Nations gave South Africa the responsibility to care for Southwest Africa, Namibia. The United Nations is trying to force a kind of government on Namibia, but the South African government wisely does not trust the United Nations. And so the situation is difficult. On the border between Southwest Africa and Angola, you have SWAPO troops, Southwest African People's Organization, making excursions into Namibia, bringing terrorism. The South African government made it clear. They said, these people belong to us. They're our responsibility. And therefore, if we can find it documented that any SWAPO people from Angola have come in our borders or are preparing to come into our borders to kill our people, we will do whatever it's necessary to stop SWAPO. So South Africa sent troops 50 miles, some think 150 miles, in order to rescue Zambezi, by the way, into Angola. And in my opinion, what South Africa did in chasing SWAPO back into Angola is no different than what the United States did in chasing the communists out of Grenada. So we're back to this double standard thing. We can do it, but they can't do it. Now, what's complicated the whole problem? As if that were not enough, the situation is worsened because the United States comes on the scene. It's not an exaggeration to say that the two greatest threats to the stability and welfare of South Africa are the Soviet Union and the Congress of the United States. Without hesitation, I say that. And over the past week, I've said that to some 10 in some 10 newspaper and TV interviews. And they put it in print. Well, now, what do I mean by that? Well, you've been reading about the Congress trying to decide whether or not to divest. Disinvestment or divestment, they're synonymous phrases. Whether or not to put sanctions on South Africa and to disinvest South Africa, to put these punitive measures against her with the hopes that that pressure will cause her to reform her policy. Well, let me point out that this, and I spoke to some of the people who said this, National Party officials. They said, we were the ones that put apartheid into effect. I'm thinking of one man in particular. He said, it was my party that's been in power since 1948. We're the ones that put it into effect, and therefore we are the ones to blame for what it's doing to South Africa. But it's obvious to anybody that has eyes to see and that's willing to see that the South African government is committed to reforming apartheid. Sometimes I wish they'd move faster than they do. Sometimes I wish they move more wisely than they do. But the point is, there are reforms, drastic measures taking place to reform things. Apartheid is dying. I predict that, and others do too, that if the reforms are kept up at a fast pace and a wise pace, apartheid will be totally dismantled within 5 years if the United States gets off their back. Now, what are some of those reforms? Well, some of the reforms they're making are cosmetic. While I was there, one of the reforms they made was they declared that all South African blacks could count themselves as citizens in South Africa. You remember that? Well, I thought that was great. At least before, they weren't called citizens, but now they can count themselves as citizens, until I start asking these governmental officials what it means to be a citizen. And they say, oh, it means you have all the rights of being a citizen, just like you do in the United States, except voting. So I just don't know whether citizenship change is cosmetic or real. But now let me ask this. How many of you have read in the press and on TV that the problem in South Africa is that black people are totally disenfranchised and black people do not have the right to vote? Anybody heard that? It's a lie. Do you know that everybody in South Africa has the right to vote? One man, one vote. It's there in South Africa. I'm here to tell you, if you don't get it from anywhere else, in South Africa, be you white, colored, Indian, or black. Every citizen, every person has the right to vote in South Africa. Now the problem is, I'm not being facetious at this point, they have the right to vote for various provincial and local leadership, but they do not yet, and this is a tragic thing, they do not yet have the vote on a national level. Now, recently, the Constitution of South Africa was changed. And in the Constitution, the coloreds and the Indians were brought into the government, but the blacks haven't been brought into the national government yet, and so that confuses the whole thing. So there are some basic reforms. For instance, now black people can hold skilled jobs. Black people can own their own property. Black people are not required by law now just to marry black people. Black people can have black businesses inside the city limits of the major population centers. There's a long way to go. I think the group area thing is still repugnant, where they have to sleep by law in a certain area. But there are reforms that are being made. Now, what complicates the whole thing is the attitude of the United States. We have people in the Congress of the United States who say that we need to put the pressure on South Africa to convince them that they need to change to make life rough on them. So therefore, we're basically going to do three things. We're going to withdraw all American business and investment. We're going to ban the Krugerrand. And we're going to disallow any loans from any private banks in the United States to the South African government. Now, there's various other things, but those are the basic three central aspects of the policy of the United States. And the point is that these things will make the government change and are for the benefit of the black man. So I went to South Africa to find out what are the effects of this policy on the black people of South Africa. Now, one of the reasons it was important that I find out is because, you know, Congress has studies on everything, don't they? I mean, the mating habits of the snail darter. And, I mean, you know, they've spent a fortune on every kind of study under the sun. Do you know one thing the Congress of the United States has not spent 1 cent on any study? The effects of sanctions on black people of South Africa. They don't have a study on that. So I saw with my own eyes and read everything I could read. I come back, I were given a stack of documentation that big, and I read about 85% of it. And I am convinced that what the United States is doing with the intention of helping the black man is worsening the economic situation of the black man, and in so doing, making the dismantlement of apartheid more difficult, and also in so doing, preparing the way for an increase of Marxist invasion and Marxist terrorism and Marxist riots and maybe even revolution. Let me tell you what I mean. All right, let's say we divest South Africa. Let's say we divest South Africa of our businesses. Do you realize that some 100,000 black people work for American businesses? 100,000? Now, the average black man in South Africa's income has to feed 6 people. We're talking about close to 1 million people that will be put below the poverty line if American businesses are pulled out of South Africa. Furthermore, what happens if we ban the Krugerrand? The gold mining industry is the largest employer of blacks in South Africa. And not only does it employ South African blacks, but there's 1.5 million non-South African blacks that come into South Africa to work, and most of them work in the gold mining industry. Thousands of non-South African blacks flood into South Africa every week. Now, does that tell you something? Have you read on newspaper, heard on TV or radio that South Africa is worse than Nazi Germany? Well, apparently 1.5 million non-South African blacks disagree, because they think there's more prosperity and freedom in white South Africa with all of its problems than there is in black totalitarian Mozambique, Zimbabwe, etc. Now, what happens when you cut off your purchasing of the Krugerrand in any significant way? It strikes right at the most important industry employing more black people than any other industry in South Africa. Now, here's what I didn't know before I went to South Africa. I did not realize that 100 million to 150 million black Africans in sub-Saharan Africa are dependent upon South Africa for their very existence. Now, by sub-Saharan Africa, I mean everything south of the Sahara Desert. some 8 or 10 nations in here: Angola, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Zaire, etc. Part of Zaire. These 8 or 10 nations south of the Sahara Desert in southern Africa. South Africa is the nation. Southern Africa is this whole region. Some 100 to 150 million non-South African blacks are dependent upon South Africa for their welfare. Why? Because most of these black nations are dictatorship, where they got into government under the guise of one man, one vote, and they wound up with one man, one vote, one time. And they have a dictatorship that to one degree or another are dominated by Marxist influence. By the way, you've got to be very wise when you talk about wanting one man, one vote for South Africa. Because we're not only talking about first world, there's a first world and a third world in South Africa. You not only have highly civilized, and then a highly technological society of blacks, whites, etc., but you also have people living in the bush the way they've been living for thousands of years, and I have pictures of them over here. And you've got to be very careful about saying you want one man, one vote overnight in South Africa, because many of these primitive people are easily manipulated by Marxists who would come in, and you could imagine what would happen. But anyway, these dictatorships, their economies are in shambles, and they do not produce enough food to feed their people. So as a result, they're dependent upon South Africa for many things. First of all, even though South Africa is only a small percentage of the landmass of Africa, it's one of the greatest exporters of food and grain in all of Africa. And it exports food to these nations to make up for their low productivity of food. Also, I didn't realize, South Africa produces all to most of the electricity of these nations. Some of these nations, like Lesotho, is 100% dependent upon South Africa for all of its electricity. Maputo, the capital of Mozambique, is about 80% dependent upon South Africa for its electricity. So most of these nations depend upon South Africa for most of their electricity. Thirdly, these nations are dependent upon the South African railway system for the transporting of all their export and import, which is their livelihood and the one thing that keeps any soundness to their economy at all. Thirdly, it is the South African airway system, particularly with its international airports like Johannesburg, that's the one reasonable, convenient contact these nations have with the international market. Furthermore, South Africa has out in both long-term and short-term loans millions of rands worth, millions of dollars worth of loans for the economic development of these countries. And as I said a while ago, there's 1.5 million blacks from these various countries that are working in South Africa, making a living. Now, what happens if all of a sudden the money market is cut off to South Africa and its economic situation worsens? Then obviously its primary concern is going to be its own citizens, and that means that there will be a massive curtailment, if not cessation, of the loans, the food, the railway services, the airway contact, and the electricity all over this part of the country. So that one political advisor to the government told me, he wasn't a government official. I said, sir, let's consider the worst scenario. Let's say the United States cuts off everything from South Africa. How long will South Africa survive? Well, you know, because of these sanctions and global boycott against South Africa, she's learned to be self-sufficient in many ways. You know, a long time ago, people quit selling her oil. You say, and she doesn't have any oil mines. She has sought desperately for oil, but she can't find any oil in South Africa. You say, well, how in the world has her industry gotten anywhere without oil? Coal. Sasol, S-A-S-O-L, a major industry. They get all their oil from coal. But anyway, what would happen, I said, if the worst scenario took place and we divested South Africa totally? He said, well, South Africa could survive easily for 5 years. He said, but friends, these 10 nations would survive for 48 hours. He said, in 48 hours, you will have 150 million people on the verge of starvation. Now, here's the question. To show you that though South Africa is 18 hours away through four time zones on the tip of Africa, that their problems are our problems, and our security and theirs are all wrapped up together. And a friend of mine who works on staff with R.J. Rushdoony, he called Otto Scott, has written this book I highly recommend to you on South Africa called The Other End of the Lifeboat. We're in one end, South Africa's in the other, and we're trying to kick them out. We're all wrapped up with them. Now let me ask you a question. What happens if the economic situation in South Africa becomes so desperate that there's 150 million new starving people in Southern Africa? Where are these starving people going to go for food? To the United States, the generous United States. Where is the United States going to get the money to provide food long term for 150 million starving people? Either through deficit spending, massive increase in inflation in the money supply, or massive increase of taxation. Divestment is racist in that it jeopardizes the economic situation of South Africa, and it's vicious in that it jeopardizes the financial situation of virtually every American. Now, there's another thing you got to realize. And that is, we are dependent upon South Africa for four strategic minerals. By the way, this place is a treasure house. It's a land of resources. Human resources, you know that there are seven exploitable minerals in South Africa. But the point is, we're dependent upon South Africa for four strategic minerals without which you cannot produce high-temperature resistant steel, such as is used in the making of jet engines like they make in Lockheed, and such as is used in the making of high-speed tools. In fact, one of these, manganese, is essential to dry cell batteries, and these four minerals are not only essential to our steel industry, they're essential to our whole defense program. Now, those four minerals are cobalt, manganese, platinum, and chromium. And we import the overwhelming majority of those minerals from South Africa. In fact, the only other place where they can be obtained in that quantity is from the Soviet Union. Now, let me ask you a question. What would happen if, because of divestment, the economic situation in South Africa became so desperate that in order to make up for their losses everywhere, they had to jack up the prices of these four minerals? You remember what happened to the American economy when the Arabs jacked up the prices of barrels of oil? You ain't seen nothing yet till you realize the implications of raising the prices to strategic minerals without which you can't make steel. Our American economy is jeopardized by divestment. And what happens if, because of the economic situation and the increase of terrorism, South Africa's pushed into the Soviet bloc? What happens if there is a cutoff of the supply of these minerals to the West? We're dependent upon South Africa for another way, and that is the sea lanes. Do you know that some 60% of Europe's oil comes from the Near East and the Middle East around that Cape of Good Hope? Do you know that some 40% of our oil comes around that Cape? Do you know that's one of the major strategic naval choke points in all the world? Whoever controls that cape controls the southern Indian Ocean and the southern Atlantic Ocean. Our security is wrapped up with theirs. So what should we do? How can we help the black people in South Africa? We can help them. Our government can help them by totally reversing itself and by encouraging new and expanded investment in South Africa. We also need to pray for South Africa.
You and I need to pray for South Africa. Before we leave this evening, we want to pray for South Africa. Pray for them. Thirdly, you need to tell other people the truth about South Africa, because they're only getting one side from the media. But I think the one group of people in the United States who, through coalition, through doing things together, through letters, through trips to South Africa and the like, through putting pressure on congressmen, the one group that can get through to the South African whites and the South African blacks more effective than any one group of Americans are Bible-believing evangelical Christians. Because the South Africans still have a Christian conscience. They still believe in the Lord Jesus Christ.